Okay? It's up to you.
Thank you for speaking. My name is Mark. I just wanted to kind of address or speak on that last question that you just posed, which was, who's actually making these decisions for whom are they being made?
Who is making
them? Who is making the decisions for whom are they being made? How are these decisions being made? I think that I share the same belief as you that there is kind of a privacy to doing things here in the U.S. One of those reasons being that this is where I am right now, so this is, you know, my decision. This is where I probably have most of an impact. And also because I believe that the extent of U.S. military and cultural hegemony is just so wide and so world-consuming that something has to happen here for it to be able to happen elsewhere. In the history of U.S. repression of movements for liberation or independence across the world is, you know, it's just an atrocious record, and it's very clear to anyone who would look into it. So, one of the criticisms that I've often heard levied against you is that you don't offer a constructive path forward. Like someone in my position would ask you, what should we do? You explain all these terrible things happening, so what should we do now? And the criticism is often you to offer like a concrete solution.
Very
which makes sense, I mean.
Very concrete solution. I mean, take the two cases I mentioned. There are others, but take global warming and nuclear weapons. We can influence those policies. We can change them. We don't face the gulag. We don't face torture chambers. In fact, today, it's a lot easier to do it than it was, say, 50 years ago, because a lot more freedom has been won, thanks to the people over these years who haven't just asked that question, but have answered it. So, for example, opposition to aggression in the United States is much higher now than it was, say, in the early 1950s. I could describe it from personal experience, if you like. I was the early 1960s. As soon as Kennedy ordered, sort of launched the major war against South Vietnam, which is indeed what happened, I was one of a few people who started protesting very hard in those days. First of all, it's impossible to get an audience. I was talking to people in their living rooms, or maybe in a church with three people or something. The first in Boston, which is a liberal city, and some of you may remember, in October 1965, that's after 4 years of a war which practically had destroyed South Vietnam. Hundreds of thousands of American troops there. The war extended to North Vietnam, and though we didn't know it at the time, also to Laos and Cambodia. There was the first effort in Boston to have a public demonstration against the war on the Boston Common, the usual place. Again, some of you may remember. There was a march from Harvard Square down to the Boston Common. There were supposed to be speakers. I was supposed to be one of them. Nobody could be heard. The meeting was broken up violently, mostly by students, incidentally. There were lots of state police, so people didn't get killed. If you take a look at the newspapers the same day, you can look up the archives. The Boston Globe, the entire front page was a denunciation of the people who dared to say, maybe we shouldn't bomb North Vietnam. That's after, which was a minor issue. You know, it was South Vietnam that was the target. We realized you can't have a public meeting in Boston. So this was an international day of protest. The next international day of protest was March 1966. The attack was even worse. The destruction was even worse. It was far and away the worst crime of the post-war era. So we decided to have it in the Arlington Street Church instead. Church was attacked. Tomatoes, cans, police. They wouldn't refuse to do anything. That's Boston, one of the most liberal cities in the country. It's by no means like that now. It takes, say, the invasion of Iraq. That was the first time in the history of imperialism in which there were massive protests before the war was officially launched. It's a big difference. And it was effective. You know, people say it didn't have an effect. That's simply untrue. The Bush administration never dreamed of doing the kinds of things that Kennedy and Johnson did without a second thought. There was just way too much public opposition. I mean, the war was pretty horrible. Practically destroyed Iraq and they never recovered. But nothing like the attack on South Vietnam in the early 60s. Well, okay, that's because people did something. And the same is true in every single one of these issues. Civil rights, women's rights, you pick it. It's perfectly possible for ordinary citizens, folks like us, to get together and do something about these things. And not if we just sit and wait. And there's plenty that can be done. You know, it's true that decisions are made, as even the academic literature points out, by a tiny sector of concentrated private power and closely linked state power. And, you know, academic institutions contribute and so on, pretty tightly narrow interlinked sectors. You know, that's how decisions are made, but they're not immune to influence. I mean, even in totalitarian states, they have to reflect public opinion. Say, take Nazi Germany, real totalitarian state. You take a look at Hitler's policies. A lot of them were designed to keep the population quiet. The Nazis fought what we call a guns and butter war. They had to placate the population, so a lot of energy was put into social reforms of various kinds, which harmed their war effort. The main architect of the Nazi economy, Albert Speer, wrote his memoirs. He claims that these efforts to keep the population quiet probably lost the war for Germany. So they retarded the war effort, his estimate was, by about a year. Well, you take a look at what was going on in the last year, the Germans were way ahead, technically, than the far ahead of the West, and of course the Russians. Jet planes, you know, rockets, all sorts of things. And who knows, if they'd had another year, maybe they'd have won the war. Well, they didn't. And one of the reasons was, even in a totalitarian state, you had to pay attention to the population. In a more or less free society like ours, it's much more the case. So I don't think we can complain at all about not knowing what to do. It's only a question of choice and will. Plenty of opportunities.
Just to clarify, I'm not one of the people that thinks that you don't offer concrete solutions. I'm not one of the people that believes you don't offer concrete solutions.
It's a very concrete solution. Take, say, global warming. Perfectly concrete solution. Impose a carbon tax, carry out weatherization, devote research, direct research to sustainable energy. Not only can it be done, it is being done. Probably the most successful state capitalist country in the world is Germany, which is moving ahead quickly towards a sustainable economy. It can be done. Actually, we're trying to impede it. If you read the business press, you'll discover that part of the cheering about our increasing our use of fossil fuels is that it's reducing energy prices in the United States, which is giving the United States an advantage over Europe, primarily Germany, in manufacturing. And that may cause them to back away from their sustainability efforts, another achievement. But it not only can be done, but it is being done, and we know exactly how it should be done, just as it's being done elsewhere, even more so here. No problem. As far as nuclear war is concerned, there's a very simple solution. There is a non-proliferation treaty, and we signed it. Article 6 says that the nuclear states must engage in what are called good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons. The World Court ruled on that some years later, mid-90s, and determined that this is a legal obligation. Not doing it is criminal. Can we induce the government to do it instead of expanding the expenditures for nuclear weapons as they're doing right now? Sure we can. same with all these other issues. Plenty of construction.
I just want to say one more thing.
Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram is actually funded by an Algerian CIA cover. So I just like your view on that, if you think that's a possibility, that the CIA is actually backing Boko Haram via Algeria. And then second of all, would you define corruption? As in, if that were true, would the CIA be corrupt, or would the government be corrupt?
Well, I don't know of any evidence for that, and I think it's pretty implausible, frankly. Furthermore, there's a lot of illusions about the CIA. The CIA is not a rogue organization. It's very convenient for the government and the whole propaganda system to make it look as if the CIA is off on its own doing horrible, crazy things. Then you can condemn the CIA. CIA is an agent of the executive. It does what it's told, overwhelmingly. Take a look at the record. You find the CIA basically does what it's told. It's an agency of the state executive, the president, which has the purpose of carrying out actions that provide the government with what's called plausible deniability. In other words, the president and his advisors order something. CIA carries it out. But then it's done in such a way that if it's exposed, they can say, we never heard of it. That's plausible deniability. But it's very difficult to find any cases. I urge you to look into it. It's a very open record. Try to find cases where the CIA went off on its own. I mean, you can find some pretty marginal cases, but by and large, it's a pretty obedient agency of the state executive, providing plausible deniability. Its crimes are the ones it's ordered to carry out. There's, again, don't take my word for it. This is a pretty open society. We should recognize that and be pleased about it. That means we have plenty of evidence, internal documents, historical evidence, and so on. You can explore and determine and see if you can find cases where the CIA actually acted on its own and carried out crimes on its own. I think what you'll find is invariably they go straight back to the state executive. I mean, there was an extreme terrorist war against Cuba, and we don't talk about it much, but it happened. There's plenty of evidence about it. A lot of it was carried out by the CIA, but that was on orders from John F. Kennedy, who assigned his brother, Robert Kennedy, Attorney General, to take as his highest priority to bring, I'm quoting, the terrors of the earth to Cuba. The phrase is Arthur Schlesinger's, well-known historian, who was Kennedy's Latin American advisor, to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba. It was his highest priority. You know, the CIA carried it out, but it was coming straight from the White House. And it was serious. It wasn't a joke. When you read about it in the press, they say, oh, well, it was, you know, like the Boston Globe recently, when this Twitter business was exposed a couple of weeks ago. There was a Globe editorial kind of criticizing it and saying, oh, this reminds us of the bad old days when the CIA was trying to, you know, burn Castro's beard and stuff like that. That's not what it was. And it wasn't the CIA. And the CIA was the agency, you know, like Kennedy didn't drop the bombs. But they were carrying out very serious attacks. Thousands of Cubans killed, petrochemical factories blown up, a ship sunk in the Havana harbor, you know, all kinds of things. Not a joke. But here it's presented as a kind of strange CIA childish trickery, not in the least. Actually, the first book taking evidence from Cuban victims just appeared by a Canadian scholar, Keith Blender. You don't see any reviews of it. It's the first study of oral history from the victims. The first thing you should look at, and we do when it's some enemy, but I doubt if many of you know about it, because we don't look at our own crimes. We just look at enemies' crimes. Not pretty. And I think that's what you'll find about the CIA pretty generally. The Boko Haram case, I just don't believe it. I don't have any evidence, and it just doesn't seem credible.
It was a WikiLeaks report.
Pardon?
He was alleging to have a WikiLeaks report indicating that.
A report from what source?
WikiLeaks.
Well, no, WikiLeaks doesn't have information about that. I don't think. If you can send me the reference, I'd like to look it up, but I don't think WikiLeaks even has documents bearing on things that current.
I have a question, perhaps a personal question, concerning a different kind of sustainability. I guess yours. Very impressed by your consistent, compassionate effort in the world. And as a practitioner, I consider you some form of a bodhisattva, actually. But kind of in the absence of maybe what would have given strength to, say, a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or the Dalai Lama, like a religious faith or a religious practice, just out of sheer curiosity, I'm interested in what kind of spiritual resources or you draw from, or any advice you give to people like our friend who wants to continue a kind of wholesome actions toward a more wholesome world. How to embolden ourselves and empower ourselves on a kind of heart level, because I'm just impressed by your tireless efforts and kind of curious how you keep going.
Yeah, so it's a question that's asked that I just don't understand. I mean, every one of you, I mean, take, say, global warming.
Yeah.
I'm sure that every person here cares about whether their grandchildren will have a way to survive. Do you need unique spiritual resources for that? I mean, there has to be something that prevents you from doing it. You know, that's what we should be asking ourselves. What prevents it? And it's the same on the other issues.
Yeah.
I mean, including serious but less outrageous ones than this. Like, take the fact that for the last roughly 30 years, the United States has had economic policies, state economic policies, state corporate economic policies, which have led to virtual stagnation for the majority of the population. Plenty of economic growth, but into very few pockets, you know, hedge fund managers and people like that, but not the population. Well, you know, I think people care about that. In fact, if you look at polls, people care a lot about it. Take taxes. For the last about 40 years, there have been regular polls asking people what their attitude is towards the tax system. Overwhelmingly and consistently, people think there ought to be much higher taxes on the rich. How does policy work? Reduces taxes on the rich. That's one of many illustrations of how policy is divorced from opinion. But I don't think it's a matter of people. I think what this shows is that people have the, if you want, spiritual resources to give the right answers. But how about doing something about it? That takes a little more than giving the right answers to a poll taker. And I think that's the question. Why do we stop short of doing the things that we know we should do? Actually, there's an interesting article by George Orwell on this, which I suspect you didn't read. Maybe you did. Everybody here read Animal Farm in elementary school. Very few people read the introduction to Animal Farm, which Orwell wrote. It wasn't published. It was found 30 years later in his unpublished papers, and it's kind of interesting. What he says is, it's directed to the people of England, of course, his audience. He says, look, the book is a satire on the totalitarian enemy, but people in England shouldn't be too self-righteous about it. Because he says, in free England, I'm quoting now, ideas can be suppressed without the use of force. Then he gives a couple of examples and a few sentences of explanation. And one reason he says is, the press is owned by wealthy men who have every reason not to want certain ideas to be suppressed. But then there's another reason, which I think is more significant. He says, a good education. If you've gone to the best schools, you went to Cambridge and Oxford, you know, Harvard and Yale and so on, you have instilled into you the understanding that there are certain things it just wouldn't do to say. I don't think he goes far enough. It wouldn't do to think, even. That's a large part of what a good education is. So you don't see things that are right in front of your eyes. Like, take everything I mentioned, which I think is pretty easy to document. It's right in front of our eyes. Why does it surprise anyone? Why isn't it taught in elementary school? Well, it's a good reason. Got to keep the population in the dark. And we internalize it, especially people like us. You know, I'm sure most of us have had what are called good educations, best colleges, and so on. Yeah, you get instilled it into you. The idea that you shouldn't think about certain things, and you shouldn't do anything, even if you know that the fate of your grandchildren depends on it. Shouldn't do it. But that can be overcome. But I don't think there are any special... There's one other point I'd like to mention about what you said. Say, take Martin Luther King. Now, he was a very significant person. I think he deserves the honor and respect that he sometimes receives. But I think he would have been the first to tell you that he was riding a wave which was created by others. Take a look at the rise of the civil rights movement. It was people like a couple of black, four or five black students in 1960 who sat in at a lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and asked to be served, you know, brutally arrested and imprisoned. Could have been the end of it, except the next day more came back. And pretty soon you had freedom riders going through the South. Tremendous courage. They were being beaten, attacked, killed. They kept coming. Mostly black students in the South and people from the North joined. Pretty soon you had SNCC was formed, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was really spearheaded the civil rights movement. And pretty soon you had a mass movement, a big demonstration. You know, and Martin Luther King was a very effective spokesperson for it and a participant. You know, he got himself arrested. He wasn't joking. But it was a wave of popular activism, and I think it's always like that if you look through history. So we should recognize the spokespersons, you know, for courage and integrity, but recognize that they're followers, not leaders.
Hi, I wanted to follow up on your parallel with such things as the civil rights movement. So I guess I'm trying to understand the second half of your statement, which is, what drives us to not act? I mean, in the case of the civil rights movement, which started much earlier than that, as you know, as a decentralized movement, people's lives depend on these things. So is it the fact that these things are not as close to home, or we don't perceive them as such, or that we have this perception that we live in such a free society, and that therefore these things can be relegated to our grandchildren or their children? So I'm just trying to understand, when you draw parallels on such things as the civil rights movement, then where's the impediment from our part to not act? So it's something that I'm trying to make sense of.
I think we can all ask ourselves that question, because it's very close to home. Now, take a look at Martin Luther King. King did extremely important work, you know, from the 50s on through right on till his death, till his assassination, in pursuing very critical issues. You take a look at the orations on Martin Luther King Day. Notice what they say. Almost always they stop with his "I Have a Dream" speech in Washington, right? Which was a mass demonstration, gave an eloquent speech. Johnson passed some important legislation, and it was not insignificant. King didn't stop. He moved on to the North, and he moved on to class issues. He was, when he was assassinated in 1968, he was participating in Memphis in support of a strike of sanitation workers, poor people, oppressed people. That's when he was assassinated. Actually, he gave a very important "I Have a Dream" speech the day before he was assassinated, but it's not mentioned on Martin Luther King Day. He used his normal biblical rhetoric, and he described himself as being kind of like Moses, you know, standing on a mountain where he could see the promised land. He knew he wouldn't get there, but he's telling the audience, you keep working on it, you can get there. The promised land was justice for the poor, not for African Americans, for the poor. He was bringing up class issues, and he was directing it against the North. That part of his life, in fact, right after his assassination, there was to be a march on Washington, in which he was going to start a Poor People's Party, Poor People's Movement. Well, the march took place. It was led by Coretta King, his wife, after his assassination. And it went through the major places in the South where the great moments had been, you know, Selma and so on. It ended up in Washington. The marchers set up a tent city, Resurrection City, in Washington. They were allowed to stay there for a while. Then the police came in the middle of the night and smashed it up and drove them out of town. Now, that was the most liberal Congress in American history. But when you bring up class issues and you turn to the North, you're going too far. And that part of his life is pretty much excised. And we should know it right here. Like, we're sitting not far from Harvard Square, right? You go back to the early 1970s. The Red Line ended at Harvard Square, right? Right now, where's the Red Line end? At the borders of Cambridge, Elwood. Why doesn't it go into the western suburbs? There was a proposal at the time to extend the Red Line into the western suburbs, Arlington, Lexington, Radnor. Okay. It didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is kind of interesting. You might research it. But nobody actually said so, but it was pretty obvious to anybody who was watching. Other than Lexington, right? Every day I waste enormous amounts of time fighting traffic to get to my office at MIT. If it had extended to Lexington Center, it would take me maybe 10 minutes. And the same is true that everybody lives there. But this is a progressive, liberal town, you know, academics, professionals, and so on. But there was a choice. Is it better to save maybe an hour a day of not fighting traffic at the cost of maybe having a black kid from Dorchester walk around Lexington Center? Well, that was the choice. And you know the way it was made. Now, take a look at busing in Boston. The busing was strongly supported by the liberals in the suburbs. It didn't reach the suburbs. Busing was set up by a liberal judge, actually, so as to get the Irish kids in South Boston to go to the black part of Roxbury, black section of Roxbury, and conversely, but not us, please. No western suburbs, okay? Not where the affluent liberals live. Now, this is duplicated all over the country. So we can ask ourselves, we have to look far, that we're the kind of people who made those decisions. Why? Well, ask yourself, you know, it's not a big research problem. And I think it generalizes very widely. It's a very good idea to look into the mirror. It's hard, you know, hardest thing to do.
just a slightly different topic, but I'm loving everything I'm hearing. Just so what's your take on the world population? The world population,
the world population,
us that are on the planet.
Well, there are two. I mean, it's a problem. You don't want the population to grow too much, and there are two ways to deal with it. One is the Chinese way, basically force. Okay. The other way is by resorting to something that works extremely effectively, education of women. It turns out when women are educated, the children. This is a very striking phenomenon, and it's independent of wealth and development. So that's why the population of Europe is going down. But it's also happening in poor areas. Like in India, there's a big overpopulation problem, with one exception, Kerala, which is a poor sector of India. But it happens to have been run by the Communist Party for years. And they have, you travel through India, some of you have. And Kerala is just unusual. You drive through, you see people sitting at a bar reading a newspaper. There's high level of education, particularly with women, fertility's gone way down. When women have choices, fertility goes down. So much so that in Europe and particularly Japan, population is beginning to decline. Okay, that's another way of doing it. You have force, or you can do it humanely.
Professor Chomsky, could we have two more questions?
I'm sorry. Yes.
So, aside from the pretty obvious, the truth of the situation getting cleared to the side, us not hearing about what's really going on, a lot of the cracks are sort of filled in with things that are kind of essentially trivial. I mean, there's celebrity culture where we're hearing about who hooked up with who, and that's meaningless, and CNN covers the Malaysian plane for far longer than that story warrants. Do you think that happens because it's what people want to hear, or because the media has an interest in not telling us about the true things that are happening?
I didn't entirely catch the example.
The Malaysian plane that went down recently and went off the radar, and everyone was...
Oh, the Malaysian plane?
Yeah, and how that was covered for... I mean, obviously, it's very tragic that those people lost their families, but CNN kind of went overboard with their coverage, I would say, rather than talking about everything else that's going on that has a much far-reaching effect.
It was certainly... It's a very curious incident. It's hard to imagine how that plane could have lost contact with the world. I mean, somebody had a cell phone. Something must have... There must have been some way for it to have established contact, but I don't really have any insight into it, frankly. I think it's a very curious incident. And just what happened, maybe some of you have a guess. I don't...
Yeah, but what my overall question was is, why do you think that the media is more interested in talking about trivial issues or, not true, as opposed to, running front page stories about global warming and about war and about famine?
You're absolutely... But that's all the time. And the media are, I think, mainly for Orwell reasons, but it's much more extensive, are concerned to... cater to try to lower the intellectual level of the population, to cater to the worst instincts, and to avoid things that might lead to serious questioning. Sometimes it's pretty startling. Take the Supreme Court. It's a very significant institution. There was just an interesting interview with some of the members of the court. Scalia, who's maybe the most interesting and thoughtful person among the Republican so-called conservatives, I don't think the word is right, but whatever you call them, the right wing of the court, he was asked where he gets his information from. His answer was pretty interesting. He said he doesn't read the New York Times because it's way too far to the left. In fact, he doesn't even read the Wall Street Journal because it's too far to the left. I think mostly Sid gets his information from talk shows. Did you ever listen to talk shows on the radio? I mean, it's near lunacy. Literally. I mean, it's way to the right of anything anywhere near the political spectrum. And there's almost no information. But that's where one of the most thoughtful, important justices of the Supreme Court tells us he gets his information from.
Wow.
Well, that's what it's for a lot of people. Actually, I listen to talk radio a lot when I'm driving, because it's kind of intriguing. Not to listen to the hosts, I mean, I think most of them are playing a game, frankly. But to listen to the people who call in, that's interesting, because they're very serious. I mean, they're what are called ordinary people, you know, a truck driver, a housewife, and so on. And they're very sincere. They're living in a total dream world, but it's one that's cultivated by these media institutions. And it has a certain kind of superficial plausibility about it. If you can put yourself inside that world for experimental reasons, you can see, seriously, it's worth doing. You can see plenty of data. A lot of them have a lot of data and information. And it's the kind that kind of supports the paranoid view of the world that developed. And those are very effective ways of controlling a population. And I think the tendency to focus on, as you point out, trivia that will maybe catch the immediate interest instead of thinking about serious questions, like what's really going on in Ukraine, for example. That's a good way of protecting power from scrutiny. I presume it's substantially conscious.
Hi, no, I'm Matt. Nice to meet you. Hi. I just wanted to piggyback kind of off what she said. You just kind of answered in part like what I wanted to ask. And I'm not nearly as smart as probably everyone in this room, but I was just kind of wondering, like, you know, when you talk about television and, like, you know, how people perceive it kind of in this way that, like, you know, there's a certain type of person that is, you know, that it's happening to, you know what I mean? But I think one thing is you're 85, you know what I mean? Like, I don't mean that, I just mean everyone in this room has a screen in front of them right now, you know what I mean? Like, every single person in here, if you ask them, probably watched, like, the repeat of Law and Order, like, on USA, like, 2 days ago, you know what I mean? The people that I live with are, you know, kind of like me, they're not, like, the smartest guy in the world, you know what I mean? And the thing that raised them wasn't, you know, their parents, it's the television, you know what I mean? It seems like you kind of undercut, like, the importance of that in people's lives. Like, you know, television has become much more pertinent in people's lives than it ever has been before. You know, back when you started watching television, no offense, like, it might have been, you know, you had the news, and you had maybe a show on for an hour at 6, where people didn't, you know, they slept in beds next to each other while they were married. But now, you know, you have this constant influx of information constantly coming at you, brought to you by McDonald's, this and that. You even address it in your own book. You know what I mean? Like, you have the four filters of, you know, media that and sponsorship that kind of influences how we see the world. But what I'm wondering is, you know, you talked about dissent and, like, mass protests, and you kind of say, like, well, you got to get out there. You know, like, it's not 1964 anymore. You know what I mean? Like, the people that I know, I don't really honestly think they, like, we had mass protests. We had the, whatever, sit around and do nothing hippie protest. We hate the 1%. There was no leader. I don't think people really know how to protest anymore because they're raised by a box on the wall. And they don't, you know, the TV at one point was just something you visited. It's something you live in now. You know, everything I'm wearing right now on my body was told to, like, they told me to wear it. You know what I mean? Like, I know this. Like, I'm wearing Air Maxes right now. I didn't even know why I bought them. But, like, something on television told me to do it, so I did. You know what I mean? So, like, you're saying, you know, everybody get out, do this protest thing, but the people that I know in my life, in my world, the television's not telling them to do that. And more importantly, if they do go out and do that, they don't even know what to do, they don't elect a leader, and, you know, they don't know what message to push, and then it's not even reported. So is mass protest really the answer anymore, or do we need to find something new? And if so, well, do you have any ideas on what that could be? Because I honestly don't believe that, you know, as much as you want to say that these things worked before, the world's a different place than it used to be in 1964. You know, it is, like, fact. So, like, what would you suggest you do in this new media landscape?
Well, you're right that the world is not like it was in 1964. Today, it's a lot easier to protest than it was in 1964. I can tell you from personal experience. I mean, I mentioned what happened in Boston in 1965 and 1966. Unimaginable now. It was much worse in other places. Like those of you who, for example, I was down in civil rights demonstrations in the South in the early 60s. That was really brutal. Really vicious and brutal. Some of you know, but certainly don't know about it. It's not happening anymore. A lot of freedom has been won thanks to the efforts of people who didn't say, I don't know what to do. They did know what to do, and they didn't wait for leaders. Like these black kids who sat in at the lunch counter, they didn't wait for some leader to tell them to do it. You know, the leaders came later. They rode the waves of these popular protests. And incidentally, just to be clear, I don't think that mass demonstrations, you know, are the main device of activism. In fact, those are usually things that come as a consequence of the serious work of organizing and local activism. And what can people do? You know, almost anything. Go talk to real activists. Like, go down to South Boston, where there's quite good groups, and ask them what they do. Well, what they do is things like trying to get people in. People feel hopeless. You know, feel you can't do anything. Big powers out there, we can't do a thing. All right, organize a group of mothers to try to get a traffic light in a street corner where their kids have to go to school. And you organize, you know, you talk to the city council, you have meetings, you make some protests, finally get the street light. It's empowering. See, I can do something. Okay, let's go on to the next thing. That's what organizing is about. Getting people to deal, to recognize that they can do things in their own lives. And for people who are privileged, like most of us are, probably all of us, there's many more things you can do. Many more. Some of the things that might happen would be mass demonstrations, which are usually good for encouraging the people who are active to see, look, there's lots more people like me. That's the main purpose they serve. And that's okay, but it's at the surface of things. Now, did people know how to carry out mass organization in the 60s? Take a look at the 1950s. It was a very quiescent period. Very little was happening. It was also a very frightened period. Way too frightened. And people were terrified of McCarthyism, although it wasn't that dangerous. In fact, you know, when young people started making fun of the House Un-American Activities Committee, people like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, when they were called and just ridiculed, it collapsed. I mean, a lot of the power of so-called McCarthyism was just cowardice, you know, a willingness to obey when you didn't have to. A little bit of courage and you could have stood up to it. When people started standing up to it, a lot of it eroded. That was the 50s. But beginning, you know, there was things happening in the 50s too, plenty in fact, but limited. When it really took off, it was people beginning from who had no experience with organizing and activism. And it's not that profound, you know, it's pretty simple. There's no major secrets about it. We can all do it on issues that concern and interest us. If it happens to be global warming, for example, we can try to do the kinds of things that are being done say in Germany and Denmark and other places. We can be try to deal with things like weatherization of homes, which would have a big impact. For one thing, it's plenty of labor for people who need work. Plenty of people do need work. Also, it's a big energy saving. They don't do it much in Europe anymore because it's all been done. But this is a big market here where it hasn't been done. Take public transportation. The U.S. is a kind of a joke. You may have seen in the newspapers a couple days ago, there was an article about how the Abe, Japanese Prime Minister, is offering low-cost loans to the United States to build a high-speed rail from New York to Washington. I mean, 50 years ago, I took a high-speed rail from Tokyo to Kyoto. And now Japan is offering us low-speed loans so we can build a high-speed rail from New York to Washington. I mean, you can take a high-speed rail from Beijing to Kazakhstan, but not from Boston to New York. In fact, the train to New York from here is maybe 15 minutes faster than when I took it 60 years ago. I mean, there's nothing like that in the rest of the world. I mean, take our health system. It's a complete international scandal. It's about twice the per capita cost of other countries, some of the worst outcomes. The reason why so-called Obamacare was such a mess is it had to work through the private insurance companies. Of course, that's going to be hopelessly complicated and intricate. Most of you know about it from your own experience. In any civilized country, you just go to a doctor or hospital and you get health care, you know, at a fraction of the cost and better outcomes. And if you go to countries with really extremely good healthcare systems, like probably the one that's best in the world is one you're not allowed to talk about, Cuba. Tiny fraction of the cost of the U.S. system and about the same outcomes in a very poor country that's under constant attack. I mean, these things are not impossible. They're done. And we can do much better because we have a lot more advantages. But not by sitting around asking what you can do. Any number of things.
Thank you, Mr. Chomsky. My question is, can class, society, private interests ever truly be reconciled with democracy? Can they ever truly coexist? Can class, society, private interests ever truly coexist or be reconciled with democracy?
Can it coexist with democracy? Well, you know, democracy isn't a yes or no affair. There are many dimensions of democracy, and they can be more or less. Class-based societies can have more or less democracy. Take our own history. You look over U.S. history, there have been periods of greater and less public influence over a policy. That's essentially democracy, right? It's varied. So during the New Deal period, tremendous, a lot of activism. I mean, labor organizing, CIO organizing, sit-down strikes, all sorts of things. It was a major factor in leading to legislation which created a kind of a limited welfare state in the United States. You know, not the Nordic countries, but not insignificant. Now, that lasted through the 50s and 60s. Since then, it's been sharply attacked and eroded, and the democratic system has eroded with it. That's why you get the results that I just described before from academic, you know, mainstream academic political science, no radical sources. Well, it can change again. I mean, the most significant popular movements in U.S. history, I think, were in the late 19th century. They actually began in Texas with radical farmers who were opposed to the New England bankers who were robbing them and began to organize the Farmers Alliance. It was mostly an agricultural country then. That spread through places like Kansas, you know, Missouri and so on. Had a, pretty soon you had a huge farmers movement. It linked up to the growing labor movement, especially the Knights of Labor, early days of industrialization right around here. It was quite a militant and active labor movement with pretty interesting insights worth reading their literature. It's pretty striking. They began to link up. It was a big popular democratic movement. Could have changed the United States dramatically. It was crushed by force, though it had an impact on progressive legislation and so on. Well, that was more democracy. And overcoming class conflict would be important, but long short of that, you can have much better functioning democracy. And you know, in some respects, U.S. democracy is actually in the lead in the world. Take, say, protection of freedom of speech. Very significant. I think the U.S. Is more advanced in that dimension than any country that I know of. And it's not in the Bill of Rights. It's in Supreme Court decisions, primarily in the 1960s. And pretty strikingly, the first and most important of them, at Times v. Sullivan, was in the context of the Civil Rights Movement. It involved the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King. In the context of mass popular action, the court reached a pretty high level for protection of freedom of speech, went beyond that later, also partly the results of activism. Well, that's important. That's an important dimension of democracy. In that respect, we're better off than England, Canada, Europe, continental Europe. So it's a mixed story. But a lot of it depends on what people do. In fact, most of it.
I think we're done with questions. I'd like everyone to know that Four Square Books is selling Professor Chomsky's books at Prospects in the hallway if you're interested. And I'd like to thank Professor Chomsky for speaking at this evening.